Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning, Internet world, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Good morning to all of you. Well, the frigid Arctic weather has descended right here on St. Louis, where I live, and it is cold outside, really, really cold out there. And so glad to be sitting here in front of my computer, warmed by the furnace, but I say to you, I know what it's like to work in this weather. Part of my job at the hospital is outside, and I am not looking forward to working today for that reason and that reason alone. I have a tremendous guest on The Cross in the Desert. She has been on a few times before, but I asked her to come on again. I'm talking about Saba. She is my British Muslim friend. She's a human rights activist, and today she's going to talk about three particular subjects: honor killings, forced marriages, and acid attacks. I saw Saba just last Wednesday give this PowerPoint presentation at a university class. Very, very passionate and powerful presentation by my good friend Saba. And of course, it was the first time I met her. Well, what a delightful person, and we are good friends, of course. And I asked her, I said, look, you have to come on my program and just go over the things that you shared. Lots of good questions. The audience in the class was riveted to her PowerPoint presentation. So, obviously, I want Saba to come back on. You might have heard her before, but we're going to talk about some things maybe we haven't talked about. And, of course, there's always new listeners. I want them to know this courageous girl who does her human rights at the risk, really, of her own life. And there's a story behind that as well. Well, before we have that interview at 10 o'clock, I want to also take us to a very, very serious subject. That is Pastor Saeed Abedini, more than 2 years in prison in Iran. And here our country is going to sit down in just a week or so with the Iranian regime and discuss nuclear rights. Well, the subject should be Saeed and Amir, and the subject should be human rights. But we are not giving up. There is a new campaign to get President Obama's attention once again on this most important vital issue. And we're going to go right now to Jordan Seculo, who was recently interviewed about a upcoming postcard blitz for Saeed. Let's listen to that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
A postcard blitz targeting the White House. The group hopes to bring attention once again to Pastor Saeed Abedini, still imprisoned in Iran after more than 2 years. Joining us now to talk about this blitz is American Center for Law and Justice's Jordan Seculo. Thanks for joining us, Jordan.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this postcard campaign. Why have you chosen this strategy?
Well, you know, this is a great example of how we're prepared to think outside the box and also work with people who may be watching this show right now and heard about Saeed's story and his plight and his family here in the United States. And we're trying to figure out how they could help. And that's the story here. It's an individual woman named Melody Aguilar who has a printing company and contacted Naghma Abedini, Saeed's wife, and asked about whether or not a postcard blitz to the White House. That her company put out the postcard, but she wanted to make sure the message was good, that it was a united message, And so we decided to not only okay the effort, but really endorse it and encourage churches and groups to purchase these postcards. The message is pre-approved, so it's a united message. You don't have to worry about crafting your own message to President Obama. And it's a simple message that we don't leave anyone behind. President Obama said that in his speech to the DNC in 2012. And we're at a situation where Iran and the United States are at the nuclear negotiating table. The deadline for those negotiations is supposed to be November 24th, and we believe a very strong message needs to be sent that there should be no deal whatsoever with Iran if Saeed is not home.
What do you think is holding the United States back right now in regards to Abedini?
Well, you look at what just happened in North Korea with the two individual Americans there, one who was imprisoned because of his Christian faith, or the Marine in Mexico. You know, when the administration gets pressure, it takes action in even the most difficult places. Mexico had people scratching their heads a bit because that's an ally and a close neighbor. But again, they got it done eventually. And North Korea, a more difficult situation, more similar to Iran. But we're not in a nuclear negotiation. So I think the administration has unfortunately done what Iran has not. Iran is not seeing Saeed as someone separate. He is an American, and so that because he's an American, he's tied to these talks. They're at the table with Americans for the first time since 1979. They're getting sanctions relief, but time is running out on that clock. So for the first time, we never wanted Saeed to be a pawn in these nuclear talks, but now we realize that if something was to be wrapped up and Saeed is still in prison, the U.S. has missed a major opportunity to get him home. This is the time when we have some leverage.
Jordan, we heard a few days ago that Saeed's mother and siblings were recently forced to flee Iran because of the threats she was receiving. Do you have any updates on that and how it could affect Saeed?
Sure. Well, he's in a very difficult situation right now because he doesn't have immediate family on the ground in Iran. Now, that may change. I don't want to give any too many details because I don't want to put anyone in danger more than that family has already been. But the mother, just imagine that, the mother of Saeed harassed to the point where she felt it was no longer safe for her to be there, even though she was really a link to the outside world for her son. So that's the situation. We think that maybe when we're across the table with Iran, they would be treating this American somewhat differently. And there have been ups and downs throughout this case. We're at day 779 of Saeed's imprisonment. But ultimately, things have gotten very tough. We're at the table with Iran currently, and at least until November 24th. So it's a time when, if you can take a postcard like this and go to our website, aclj.org, or the printing website as well, which is available and is out there, and as a church, as a leader, and make sure that the White House gets this message loud and clear through any means possible. And I hope this is an inspiration, this postcard campaign, for people out there who may not be the ACLJ and may not work in an organization like ours and wonder how, or they can't broadcast like CBN News, but wonder how they can help. Be creative. And if you come up with a good idea, you may end up just like Melody here, who came up with this printing idea for the postcards.
All right. Thank you, Jordan. And to learn more about how you at home can help, don't forget to visit cbnnews.com.
You can also go to the BeHeardProject.com. This is the official page for the news about Saeed. BeHeardProject.com will give you all the necessary information. My thoughts and prayers with Nagma, with Rebecca, with Jacob, with Zibanda, just all of them are in my constant thoughts and prayers that there will be a breakthrough very soon. Mexico, North Korea, now it's time for Iran to condescend and to let Pastor Saeed and Amir come home. And that's why this campaign is so important, that we make our voices known. You may think, well, is this really going to do good? Yes, it does. It keeps his case alive before the president, before the administration. This is a primary example of what human rights can do when we bombard, when we make known the cases by being involved in the media all the time. So go to BeHeardProject.com. More information on the postcard blitz for Saeed in the White House. Well, when I was at the lecture with Saba last Wednesday, there were three specific topics that she lectured on: honor killings, forced marriages, and acid attacks. And my friend did such a thorough, good job with statistics and a good PowerPoint presentation. I thought that in order to enhance your understanding of these subjects, as Saba will explain in about 20 minutes from now, I want you to hear these specific examples, these sound bites, of honor killings this morning because this is such a horrific practice. A few years ago, there was a famous case in Texas where two young Muslim daughters were killed by their father, a taxi cab driver, in the cab. Their names, Amina and Sarah Saad. And the man, Yasuf, is still at large after killing his own daughters. I want you to hear about this very, very important case right now on the cross in the desert.
Well, Kelly's Court is back in session on the docket today. Two beautiful American girls allegedly murdered by their own father because they had become too Western. Sisters Amina and Sarah Saad gunned down 9 months ago. As the murder took place, one of the girls called 911, identifying her killer.
911, what is your emergency?
Oh, my God, I'm dying.
What's going on, ma'am?
I'm dying, Muslim.
Oh, my God.
Stop it.
Well, now for the first time, the FBI says this may have been an honor killing, something the family believed all along. And the family thinks that that father, Yasser Saad, may be getting help from his own brother who lives in Westchester, New York. Watch as Greg Jarrett tried to get the facts from that brother.
Are you Yasin Saad? May I speak with you on camera? Do you know where your brother is?
Nice. So does the honor killing label change this case? And if that brother is helping Yasser Saad, might that brother also face charges? Let's ask our panel, Fox News legal analyst Lise Wheel and defense attorney Mark Eiglarsch. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Megan.
So good for Greg for going out there and doing that investigation, trying to pin down that brother, because the family thinks he's behind this, that he's helping Yasser Saad, although we don't have proof of that. Lise, first, let's talk about the honor killing label. At last, the FBI comes out and says, yep, they think so too. Does that change the case legally?
Well, first of all, Megan, you got to call a crime for what it is. I don't care whose feelings are hurt in this. And yes, it does change the crime legally because it shows two things. One, when this gets to a trial, when this guy is caught and put in front of a jury, it shows motive. Why did he do this? Why would he do such a terrible thing? The honor killing goes back a long time. It shows why he would do it. And second, it shows premeditation, Megan. He didn't just flip out. He did this in a premeditated way. That's first-degree double murder. Mark, do you agree?
I do agree, and I think that the positives of labeling an honor killing, for sure, as Lise just mentioned, is for prosecution. The other thing is for prevention. You want that to get out there so people know the signs. When someone complains, like these girls did, that there are bruises on their bodies and that their father has done this, they'll take it more seriously when they know that behind those words is a guy who believes in killing his own offspring instead of putting them in a timeout when they do activities that he doesn't agree with.
Right, and the mother, who knew this man was dangerous,
right,
foolishly let these girls go in the back of this guy's cab with him. Lise, let me ask you this. The Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE, which is an organization
right,
our viewers know well, says, as far as we're concerned, until the motive is proven in a court of law, this is just a homicide, and calling it an honor killing may stigmatize the Islamic community.
It's tough, okay? I'm sorry. You do anything. The FBI uses any tools that they have to try to get this guy. He is a fugitive. And if you slap that label of honor killing, it may get people, even in the family. Remember, the grandmother was the first one to say, hey, she thinks it was the father. And look, honor killing does exist, and you can wish it away, but I actually interviewed a woman many years ago in jail. She was in jail for trying to drown her two children and herself. Why? Because her husband was going to divorce her, and in her community, that was dishonorable.
But Mark,
exactly.
Let me get to the brother. If the brother helped him, which is what the family believes, we can't prove it yet, get out of this country or hide him someplace, what charges could he face?
Accessory after the fact, if he definitely assisted him and he knew that he had committed this offense, for sure he's facing that. I want to go back to one thing Lee said. I don't like the who cares argument, okay? I don't know how labeling this an honor killing at this point is going to help at this time further trying to find this guy. That's the first thing. And here is the only disadvantage, and I know many people will say who cares, but by throwing this out there, people may erroneously think that anyone of Middle Eastern descent believes in killing their own children.
No, that's
and that's
not
no.
But there is a problem, and it has come to America, as the documentary we recently did proves. Got to go, guys, because we're out of time. Lise and Mark, thanks so much for your insights. One final word for our viewers. This was clearly an honor killing. The evidence is overwhelming, and the attempt by CARE to dismiss it as domestic violence is offensive and foolheaded. This man must be caught, and the best place to start is with that brother, who appears to know more than he is saying. Greg weighs in on it right after this break. Well, already the mail is pouring in on our Kelly's Court this morning, and as you saw, Greg Jarrett investigated the case of Amina and Sarah Saeed. Is there any doubt? CARE doesn't want to call it an honor killing.
No doubt it's an honor killing. None whatsoever. He had threatened to kill them before he eventually murdered them because they were dating non-Muslim men. They were wearing Western clothing, and then he carried it out. Honor killings, 5,000 of them a year in the Middle East. They're never prosecuted. They're condoned by law enforcement. That's according to the United Nations. And here in the United States, they're happening now on a frighteningly increasing basis.
Yes, and let me ask you about the mother. Where was she in all of this?
She may have unwittingly lured the girls into the taxi cab where they were executed. She would not talk to me. We have tracked where she is. We're keeping a close track on this. She was a tool, essentially. She was brainwashed by Yasser Saeed.
Yeah, and the brother's no fan of yours.
No, he doesn't much care for me.
Nor Fox News, for that matter. Right back at him.
That doesn't bother me.
Well, of course, that particular soundbite is from a few years ago, just 9 months after these horrific killings took place in Texas. Again, honor is compromised when women have a choice, when women exercise their free wills in dating, in careers. This is deplorable. Again, the rights of women absolutely forbidden in an Islamic setting like this, and this man is still at large. My good friend Saba, on her next semester at university, is going to actually show the documentary film based on this case called The Price of Honor, and we will be also talking about that very, very soon. I want to continue on this subject of honor killings. It's not only in the United States, but it's all over the world, of course, and this is a particular case taking place in Sweden. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
This young woman moved to Sweden from Iran a decade ago. The new life meant a new school and new friends. But her family, steeped in tradition, did not agree with her new lifestyle.
When my father learned that I had Swedish friends, he told me not to spend time with them. I refused. Then he and my brother started beating me severely, me, my sister, and my mother, who defended me.
After her father threatened to kill her, the young woman ran away to a different city. Now Fatima, as she has decided to call herself, has been in hiding for several years. Fatima's story is an example of a so-called honor crime, when parents, mostly from traditional Muslim families, used violence against women to force them into arranged marriages or prohibit them from integrating into society.
It was their parents that came to Sweden for a better life, and the girls grow up and want more freedom than the parents can give. And girls see what opportunities other girls in Sweden have when it comes to family conflicts. I know about 2-3 murder cases in Sweden, and we have also had some girls jumping from balconies.
One such story rocked Sweden 7 years ago. The 26-year-old Turkish immigrant Fadime was intimidated by her family for dating a Swedish boyfriend. She ran away, but was found and shot by her father. Her funeral was televised live and attended by members of the royal family. Fadime's death sparked massive debate in the moderate Swedish society and led to the creation of several civil organizations helping honor crimes victims. Marianne Forslund heads one of these, and says unfortunately they are still swamped with work.
We started with 10 girls 5 years ago, and last year we had 160. We helped them to change their surnames, and we provide them with housings in other cities where you can't find them.
Secrecy, that's what these organizations pay special attention to, as the reason for the 2002 killing was that the woman's enraged family had managed to find her. During our interview with her, Fatima was very nervous and insisted that we do not show specific traits of her appearance. She has found a job she likes and says she is getting on well, but she is still very scared.
I would rather live in loneliness and struggle to survive rather than going back to what was my home.
Sweden's Muslim community is estimated at 300,000 people. Social workers stress that the problem does not apply to all Muslim families. 300 to 400 girls a year run away from their homes to escape abuse. But this, they say, does not make honor crimes less of a threat.
They have come here to seek a better living, but it seems not all of them are ready to live a new life and to leave traditions behind. And while the Swedish government is investing into prevention of honor-related crimes, the number of women applying for help every year is not diminishing. Alexei Roshevsky, RT, Gothenburg and Stockholm, Sweden.
When I think about these victims that do survive, are those that are aware that something serious is going to happen to them, I think there should be some kind of safe house for honor people. People that are involved in situations potentially that can become dangerous and life-threatening. There needs to be a safe house in every city. There needs to be a place, just like a women's battered shelter, there needs to be a place for these particular women to get counseling, to get help, to get safety. If they sense, if they feel something bad is going to happen, because to wait around is to just ask for more trouble and to ask for physical violence to take place. Sadly, not too many people involved in honor situations like this survive these brutal physical assaults. So there needs to be a place where women can go that live in these family situations, in these group community situations, that fear that an attack could be upon them. Also, I believe in some type of 24-hour helpline. And there needs to be more done as a preventative so that these statistics don't continue to rise. Now, of course, my good friend Saba is going to address all these situations when she comes on our interview in just a few minutes, but I want to take us to a CNN interview with Irshad Manji. She's going to kind of talk about the whole background to honor killings and what causes them. We're going to listen to that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
For more on the prevalence of this crime is Irshad Manji. She teaches moral courage at New York University and is the best-selling author of Allah, Liberty, and Love, on how faith and freedom can be reconciled. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I just want to look at this term, honor killings. How did that come about? What does it mean? What does it say about the cultural background to this crime?
Right. Well, the word honor sounds very honorable to Western ears, but what we in this part of the world mean by honor is the dignity of the individual. But there are other parts of the world, and you've just named them, in which honor is seen as being about the group and about the reputation of the group. And this kind of honor is found, for example, in Arab tribal areas, where women are told that they are the carriers of shame for the entire family. So that if a woman, under the code of honor, is seen to be or even accused of being immoral, accused of shaming, then it's not just she that is being shamed by herself. Because she carries the reputation of the wider family, she is seen to be shaming a much bigger group, so that the punishment against her has to compensate that wider group. And that is why, in cases like this, murder is perceived to be acceptable by the parents.
And it's so irrational when you put it like that as well, but it does seem to be on the up, or are we just reporting it more?
It's hard to say, Max. We hope, of course, that it's not on the up, but the fact of the matter is that over the last many, many years, media have underreported this phenomenon. And so I think with a heightened awareness about these stories, in various parts of the world, more and more people are beginning to see that all cultural differences are not to be celebrated, that just because something happens in the name of culture does not mean that it must be embraced. And certainly even here in New York, where I teach young people, a lot of them come into my classroom not knowing that they're permitted to criticize other people's cultures and not just their own. We have to be willing to criticize if we're going to defend the universality of human rights.
Irshad Manji, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
And of course, a couple of years ago, a very important documentary film came on the scene. And one of my guests, Zainab Khan, was on this particular project called Honor Diaries. I'm hoping that there will soon be a sequel to this. So many of the human rights participants in that film were Muslims, and they were breaking the silence for the first time. They were standing up and saying, this is deplorable. Culture does not have to do this to women. Culture is no excuse for abuse, as the subtitle of the Honor Diary film. I've seen this a couple of times, and it's one of the most popular, powerful documentaries on the subject of female genital mutilation, forced marriage, and honor killings. And it needs to be out there. More and more, this film is being screened publicly. And you would think that this is a well-known topic and subject, but at lots of these screenings, some of those that come to watch this are shocked that this is really going on. They're not aware of just how widespread honor killings are. And it doesn't only involve the female. There is also the male. Even in Pakistan, where they have acid attacks, a good majority of those acid attack victims are men as well as women. And so it's not just gender-related to women. It can happen to anyone. So it's a subject that needs more attention. That's why I've invited my guest Saba here this morning, who's going to give us more insight onto it. But attacks that happen. Can you imagine a family member wanting to change a career? Or a family member choosing to marry someone outside of the group mentality? Or a family member wanting to believe something different? The group mentality, the community mentality says no to this. If you do this, you are dishonoring us. And the only recourse to this type of dishonor, unfortunately, is physical violence, is death. And there are so many examples. The number one place for honor killings in the world is Jordan. Acid attacks, 8,500, just forced marriages. You see this happening now on a global scale. And films like Honor Diaries draws attention to this horrible, horrible, seemingly epidemic. And one of the things that's hard for me to understand is that in these communities, why is it that it has to go to the level of killing? Why is it there can't be some type of constructive dialogue? Why can't there be something worked out? But no, it seems like that the number one solution to these honor infringements, breaking the community code, is to kill. That's because in the Islamic world, in these Muslim-majority countries, honor and shame are hot-button issues. I thought back to May when a young girl, I think she was 25, 27, Parveen, decided as a Pakistani, I'm going to marry someone outside of the group mentality, outside of the honor mentality. And she should have that right. But when her family found out, they demanded that she break up this relationship or to pay a sum of money. And neither of them had the money to pay. And it wasn't more than a few days after this confrontation that Parveen and her spouse, Parveen herself was walking to a courtroom or a court in Pakistan to contest this whole case. And as she was publicly walking in broad daylight, she was attacked by the community. They stoned her to death publicly in open sunlight. Right in broad daylight, this stoning took place in Pakistan. Well, the laws in Pakistan do not provide protection for women. Like this, Parveen died a senseless, incredible honor-killing, stoning death. And this should not be. But the laws are the things that need to be changed in countries like this to where it makes it a number one premeditated crime to do this to a woman, to do this to a man, simply because of their choice. So the problem is very difficult. And I've had my friend Zainab on the program. We've talked about this. Not only do we need to educate, but we need to also go into the actual countries and lobby for law changes. Because the bottom line is, unless it becomes a real crime, unless the law is behind this and will punish the offender, this will continue. Another way that a solution to this is to actually go into the family setting and really educate and dialogue with them as to this never needs to happen. But the code is so strong, as we heard in this interview, the honor is such a big, big issue that it becomes very, very difficult to break the cultural tradition, to change the laws, to do something about this situation. So a movie, a documentary film like Honor Diaries is a godsend. I think that before this movie came out, before this documentary came out, I was not as aware of the depths of these issues like Honor Diaries explained, and they have real cases on this film. If you've never seen this film, I highly recommend that you go to one of the screenings, that you rent it, that you purchase this, because Honor Diaries really informs. It really, really breaks the silence. Something needs to be done, and one of the steps is education, of course. That is a pivotal step to where we get to talk about the issue, we get to have questions and answers about the issue. And that's one of the things my guest did a few months ago, was to have a screening at her university for the film Honor Diaries. And we're awaiting Saba. She should be here any second right now. But I make this point. I really appreciate you taking the time today and to come here. Thank you, Vito, for coming to the chat room. Thank you, Sarah, for coming into the chat room. You're not going to be disappointed. My guest has a lot of background in this, a lot of information. She's been on our program before, and she knows quite well of what she speaks about. And she will be informing us about the statistics, about her own personal journey, why she does human rights, why she's so interested in this topic. And that's what we do here on The Cross in the Desert. We try to bring guests in that have an education, a background, a knowledge of the subject. And Saba has just that kind of knowledge. I want to tell you also, awaiting Saba, how well received the new book is. I'm really glad to report that my new book, The Cross in the Desert, has been the subject of many, many retweets in the last week. And I'm glad to hear Iranian human rights activists are busy out there, and I thank them so much for retweeting my book. It is a pleasure to write about my Iranian friends. And of course, if you've never seen the new book, on the front cover is a picture of Rehana Jabari, who was the victim just over 3 weeks ago of another murder by the Iranian regime. She was a woman who defended herself against a rapist, who stood up and said no to rape. And because she stabbed a man that was a former government agent, and this is a sad thing, and she was eventually put to death. Because in Iran, it seems like the message that is sent is, if I'm a woman and I defend myself against a rapist, I will be executed. And this is, of course, the sad, sad message that is being sent by a person like Rehana. It was probably one of the most painful, painful blogs that I ever wrote, the story of Rehana Jabari, but I dedicated my new book to her. And in the front part of the book, I wrote the following message about Rehana, and I want to read that to you right now. This book is dedicated to the beautiful soul of Rehana Jabari, a 26-year-old suffering martyr who was unjustly executed on October 25th, 2014 in Tehran for the crime of self-defense. Rehana was the victim of an unjust and cruel government who punishes and executes women for defending themselves against rape attacks. For over 7 years in prison, Rehana endured torture and endless hours of interrogation at the hands of barbaric men. Yet during those horrible, terrible years of pain, humiliation, and suffering, Rehana wrote more than 10 prison letters defending herself. In the first letter, Rehana writes, quote, "Perhaps someone in this world will hear my cries and feel my pain. I have heard your cries, dear Rehana, and I have felt the burden of your intense pain. I will never forget your suffering, and I will tell the world the truth about your unjust and cruel execution." Just 10 years before her 27th birthday, Rehana stepped into the arms of a loving God. The cruel Iranian regime can no longer touch or hurt her. She is finally free. This new book is dedicated to Rehana Jabari. It contains two particular stories that I wrote about her. But the rest of the stories in the books is actual word-by-word, in their own words, stories from my Iranian friends as they describe life behind the Iron Curtain of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this, to me, is one of the most important books I've written, because it puts my Iranian friends, it puts a face on them. It puts them out on display. In the past, I've written novels about the circumstances and life in Iran, but this is the first book that actually allows them an opportunity face to face. You will hear their stories. You will hear about their hopes, their dreams, their fears. It will cause you to weep for them, and hopefully it will cause you to pray for them. So I'm very excited about this new book, because it spotlights them. The stories in there are true stories. These are things that have happened to them in their lives, and they have actually shared it with me. And in some cases, I've had to correct a few of their English words and to write things a little differently, but the meaning is the same. My first story in there is my friend Maral, who lives in Shiraz, and she describes Iran as one big prison, and that the government chooses everything for us like a child. And she asks in this particular story, be our voice for freedom. And it is a privilege and a pleasure to have her in my book. In some cases, I've retained their actual names, their first name. And in other cases, I've had to delete their names for security reasons. And it is a very risky, volatile thing for them to be involved in this because it's something that they have to do. It's something that is dangerous for them to do, but they do it for the cause of freedom. And I say this to you now that I just am so excited about this new book. It is a book that I never thought I would write. It was only this past summer that I just sat down and said to myself, I don't want to write another novel. I want to write something that really puts a face on them. And I thought about my blogs, the stories I've written about my friends. And I thought, well, that's good, but the public needs to actually hear from them. I wish they could be with me on the many Skypes I've had. I wish they could actually hear what they have to say. And then it came to my understanding, the best way to talk about my friends, the best way to put a face on them is to actually have their own stories word for word in my book. And so a little bit later on in the program, I'm going to feature a few readings from my new book, and you will hear them describe things in their own words, because I think that's the best way for you to get to know my Iranian friends. Well, our dear friend Saba is unusually late. She's really, really right on time, and I'm wondering if the cold, bitter weather or car problems or something may have delayed her. So we're going to wait patiently here for our special guest Saba to come on. But until then, right now, what I think I'm going to do, I'm going to feature this special song that I want to dedicate to all of the suffering victims who have survived honor killings. There have been survivors. And I want to dedicate this song to those that are suffering in oppressed countries, that the God that I worship and the God that I serve is a God of unconditional love. And I want to play a song, a very popular song, based on the story of the prodigal son. It was actually sung by Benny Hester a few years ago. It's called When God Ran. Let's listen to it right now on the cross in the desert. And I'm glad to report that our dear friend Saba has now joined us, and we'll get back to that song a little bit later, but I want to get right to her. And I want to welcome to you my good friend Saba. She is a British Muslim, a human rights activist, and she now joins us on the cross in the desert.
Hi.
Good morning, Saba.
Morning. How are you?
Well, I know it's bitterly cold out there, and so I hope and pray that you're not sitting outside of the building and talking to me. I hope you have a warm spot to do this interview.
I'm actually on my way to a building right now because I went to a building and there was no signal, which is why I'm a little bit late in calling. I'm sorry about that.
No problem whatsoever. We understand that technology has its limitations, but we're so glad that you could join us. And hopefully we'll keep that signal so that you can talk to us this morning. I know it's very, very cold out there, and so I hope you get to a very warm place. Well, Saba, I want to reacquaint some of my new listeners that have never heard about you before. There are always many, many people who listen to this broadcast that have never heard your story. And you're very, very passionate about rights for women. And just this past Wednesday, I actually attended your lecture at university and your powerful PowerPoint presentation. We're going to talk about the subject of that. But really kind of tell us, the new listeners, our listeners, tell us a little bit about who you are and why you're so passionate about human rights for women.
Okay, basically, I'm a British Muslim, like you said. And my main focus is trying to educate people about the abuse and suffering that women endure in Muslim-majority societies, such as honor killings, acid attacks, forced marriages. And I feel like it's an important subject. Like, it really, I know, touches me on a deeper level, because a friend of mine, his older brother was actually a victim of an honor killing. And throughout high school, I have seen many of my classmates just disappearing one by one. And I know how difficult it is to be a Muslim woman, like leading a double life, because I do that myself. A couple of weeks ago, I screened honor diaries at my college campus. Sorry, I'm a little out of breath. And I had to do that secretly because my brother comes to the same college and my family does not approve of what I do. They say I'm committing a sin by exposing these this injustice, pretty much, because they say I'm going against my religion. So pretty much going against the grain is going, you know, committing a sin, basically. So I had to, like, advertise the event very secretly, which was very, very difficult. Putting up posters where my brother would not see them, talking to people who don't know my brother. So I couldn't, like, get to the whole crowd. And I had to make sure that my brother didn't find out from other people either. So it was a challenge.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I admire so much about you. Not only are you passionate about the rights of women, but you go against the grain. As a Muslim woman, you cannot not speak up. You see something that is an atrocity, that it's wrong. They say what you do is a sin, but I would say what the Muslim communities are doing to women is the greater sin. They are punishing women for making choices in regard to who they can go out with, to what they can believe, to the careers they choose. So you put your life at risk by being a voice for the voiceless, and that's why I'm so impressed with you, because it takes a lot of courage, and as you mentioned, it puts your life at risk. I remember at the lectures, some of the participants, those attending, we're concerned that this same event could happen to you.
There's a very good chance that it could. For example, like the Muslim community in St. Louis, pretty much, sees me as the devil, as an infidel, because of what I do.
Yes, and you know, I get the perception with this community that unless you're like a sheep, that you follow the crowd, that you walk in step with what they say and do, that if you dare to go against the grain, then you're basically shunned.
Yeah, like even if I question my religion, if I don't understand anything about the religion, and I question someone at the mosque, like an imam or somebody, someone with religious authority, I am just met with aggression. They're like, why are you questioning? You're just like supposed to blindly accept what is.
So. That's not what God calls us to do, Saba, to accept things blindly. In fact, when I read my Bible, there were many, many of the disciples of Jesus that asked many, many questions, and he would never once turn away those questions. So you should have that freedom to ask anything.
And like when it comes to women, women cannot ask anything. They are just supposed to follow what the men say. And that kind of comes to one of my favorite quotes, which is what I started my lecture with last week. It's actually from a Khaled Hosseini book called A Thousand Splendid Sons. And it's my favorite quote because it kind of just kind of illustrates the central concept of what is happening in the culture. And the quote is, like the compass needle that points to the north, a man's accusing finger will always point to a woman, always. That no matter what happens, a woman is always to blame. And it's not the religion, it's just the culture, it's just the way people think.
Yeah, when you started your PowerPoint presentation, that was the very thing that you began it with, because you're trying to set the tone that a woman is always at fault, that she's always to blame in this cultural setting, that she is singled out for her decisions if the family community doesn't like it. It dishonors them. And this concept of honor is very, very difficult for us Westerners to get our minds around. The idea of honor is that you cannot step outside the norm. Decision-making is always a community thing, right?
Yeah. Like it's
so
either community or family.
Mm-hmm.
Like even if it's a family decision, it's something that cannot go against the community. It's like what society expects of you.
Exactly. Now, I wanted to start with how your lecture began, because my listeners have been educated about what's happening in Iran with the various acid attacks against women in the last month, and you began your presentation with examples. You had visuals, pictures, and audio clips and video clips of the acid attacks in Iran, and really kind of explain a little bit about, you know, men throwing acid in women's faces. Where is this so prevalent in the Middle East? What countries does this happen a lot in?
In the Middle East, it's most common in Iran, especially over the past couple of weeks. It's like if a woman is seen driving or has makeup on or just little things that American women take for granted, it's seen as a crime, like in the Middle East. But the actual hotspot for acid attacks is actually Bangladesh, which has 500 reported cases of attacks every year. And that's just reported. So it's kind of scary how many cases are going unreported.
Yes, and you mentioned throwing acid in women's faces. One of the occasions for that in the past month in Iran was that these women were not properly veiled. They call it a bad hijab. They're showing too much hair or skin. And they were targeted simply because of that.
Yeah, like if their veil is too loose or it's not covering enough. I don't know why, but it's kind of like a public service. It's not just the police doing it, it's the general public. They're told to attack women if they see women like kind of not conforming to the laws, pretty much.
Now, I've seen pictures of these women, and their faces are almost scarred for life and disfigured for life. But there is a particular film that you talked about that gives hope to these acid attack women. And one of the names of the film was called Saving Face. Tell us a little bit about that film and how this gives hope to some of the victims of acid attacks.
Saving Face actually focuses on acid attack victims in Pakistan. And it gives them hope, them that, no, you're not useless. People are not scared of you. And these victims are often seen working in beauty salons. And in Pakistan, men are not allowed to go into beauty salons. It's just like it's strictly women only. So it kind of gives them safety because they're away from men. But it also gives them independence to earn a living.
Mm. Now, there's a particular man in that movie who actually does perform surgeries to help restore the faces of these victims.
Yes, and his name, I think, is Dr. Gerard. He's a British plastic surgeon, and he practices in England, but when he found out that this was happening in his homeland, he went there and actually helped these women for free. And he also worked on a British model who was also a victim of an acid attack, Katie Piper. She
yes.
was disfigured by her ex-boyfriend.
And there's an actual, I think there's an actual documentary in a book called My Beautiful Face that talks about her long journey.
Yes, she's telling people about her struggle, her journey, and pretty much everything she went through since the acid attack through her books. And I think she's been writing poems as well, but the books and documentary, I think it's called My Beautiful Face, pretty much, like, if you want to know about her, it chronicles everything from beginning to end.
Now, when I think about these victims and the hope they're given, I think about the statistics of acid attacks and the mentions in the country of Pakistan, where your family is from. These men are also targeted in Pakistan. I was a little bit surprised to see that men themselves were also victims of the acid attacks.
That happens very rarely, but yes, they can be victims. And usually it's younger men, and it's if they're associated. It's kind of similar to honor killings, that if the woman is a victim, if she runs away with somebody, the man is just as likely to become a victim as the woman.
Now, one of the things I liked about your PowerPoint presentation as I sat in the class was that you showed the visuals. You did not shy away from showing some of the things that are difficult for us to gaze upon. You showed these victims and the way they're disfigured, and I think you did that for a reason, that you want to make a point about how serious this practice is.
Yeah, because when you hear acid attacks, people don't realize, I feel like people don't realize to what extent these attacks happen. And I use visuals because I feel that if people see how bad this is, it's going to stick in their mind, and then they're going to, in a way, feel compelled to do something, or at least if they can't do something, then they can spread the word that these things are happening. And it's not just, you know, on the other side of the world. It's happening in Europe. And if it's happening in Europe, you know, the next fear is that, will it come to America? I hope it doesn't, but like forced marriages and honor killings have already spread to America.
Yes. Yeah, that's the next subject I wanted to talk about. I found your presentation really helpful for me because you actually cited a verse from the Quran that says that you cannot marry women against their will, so that what you were saying, that the Quran even actually speaks against forced marriages. And as a Muslim, tell us a little bit about that.
Like the verse?
Yes.
I think the verse. I don't remember
you
the
are,
verse.
You are forbidden to inherit women against their will.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, basically, a marriage is not acceptable unless a woman says yes. But if it's through manipulation, then the woman is trapped because once she says yes, that's it. It's just like, I don't know, it's just a trap, basically. But like child marriages, which are consummated through rape. Personally, I don't accept that because for a child, a wedding is like playing dress up. And I mean, you probably remember some of the cases I spoke about in the lecture. They were very disturbing.
Yes, Saba Massage.
Yeah, and children, the 8-year-old from Yemen, and the clip I showed from Honor Diaries, is just like, if a child knew what these marriages are going to do to them, no child would willingly say yes to that.
There was one particular case that you brought up from Pakistan. Her name was Saba Masood. She was 18. She actually survived an honor killing because she was in a situation where she was being forced to become a bride.
Yes. But she ran away to marry her lover. And she was, she was pretty much kidnapped by her father, her uncle, her aunt, and three of her uncle's friends, slapped and beaten with a metal rod, shot in the face and on her hand, and then stuffed in a sack and thrown into a canal to pretty much bleed to death. But she was actually unconscious. So when she came to and realized that, you know, something's happening to her, she struggled to climb out of the canal and got help. And she married her lover, and she's living with her in-laws, and she's completely disowned from her family.
Yes, these child brides are frightening. At the age that these women are forced into these situations, some of them 6 and others 8 years old, and how can they justify marrying children like this against their will at that age?
Usually it's to settle like feuds between families or debts. It's like if they can't pay a debt, they're just like, okay, I can't give you the money, but here's my daughter.
Hmm.
I don't understand how they can compare a child's life to money.
Hmm.
To me, that's just sickening.
These are situations where if I can't pay a debt, I can give my child. And this is a practice that goes on in not only Pakistan, but in India as well. I think there is a video that talks about this called Veil of Tears, where women are treated this way. So child brides is nothing new. It's something that's a practice within a family, as you mentioned. I want to touch on the next subject because before you came on, I was talking about this subject, about the subject of honor killings, because how frightening this is. Since we're talking about a specific code you have to adhere to, you are having an opportunity in the next few months to have an entire month dedicated to human rights and women's rights issues, and you're going to show a particular documentary of a famous case. Tell us about that case.
Okay, that case actually happened in America. I think it was back in 2008, but I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with it. It's where the two sisters, Amina Said and Sarah Said, 17 and 18 years old, were actually shot by their father for being too westernized. They actually had American boyfriends, and their father, when he found out that he couldn't control them, they weren't going to accept the relationships that he had set up for them back home in Egypt. He just got rid of them, which I don't understand, because he himself had married an American woman, but for his daughters to marry outside the faith, it was totally forbidden, which I don't understand. It's like, how can a Muslim male marry a non-Muslim, but it's not right if a Muslim woman does the same thing?
Yes, that's an interesting point you bring up. It's like a double standard, and he was able to marry someone non-Muslim, but the woman herself is not allowed to do that. She must stay within the Muslim community and marry that. So I see your point there. This was such a pathetic, horrible case because when this happened, Saba, CARE, the Council of Islamic American Relations, stood up and said, well, there's no proof that this was an honor killing. It was nothing more than a homicide. And so they tried to skirt over the issue of what really happened.
Mm-hmm. CARE seems to have a problem with anything anybody does to expose these issues. Like, I heard about a lot of screenings that were postponed of Honor Diaries because CARE was creating a huge issue about it. And when I used to do presentations on campus, they're kind of like joined with the MSA, the Muslim Student Association, on campus here, and they used to create a lot of problems for me, saying I was anti-Islamic because I was trying to speak up about women's rights within Islam. And since then, I've kind of been called the devil, because I speak up about this, and they say it's not my place to speak up. I'm a woman. I should just stay quiet. So it was really difficult, but it didn't stop me.
Good for you. Good for you. You know, in the movie, the documentary film Honor Diaries, we have an example of many Muslim women who are not afraid to break the silence and stand up. And so I think that's so encouraging, and you've had an opportunity to interact with them. They're going to give you some support in your situation. And so this is, should encourage you, Saba, that there are other Muslim women that are unafraid to speak up just like you.
Yeah, after watching Honor Diaries, I was so happy that there are other women like me, because up until I saw the documentary, I always felt like I was alone. And like I mentioned in some of my previous interviews, I was kind of like on an emotional roller coaster, because my family and my community were always telling me that I'm committing a sin and I'm wasting my time and nobody cares. But I still kind of like pushed on. Like sometimes I kind of went underground and just did research that I wasn't so active. And then I used to, every year or so, I used to come up and be active and do the presentations and movie screenings. But after Honor Diaries, it just really gave me the strength to just continue no matter what anyone says. So I would really like to thank everyone who was part of Honor Diaries for giving me that support and encouragement for, like, you know, to just continue.
This is very important. Now, what I really, really am excited about is that you have taken this information about honor killings, forced marriages, and the situation with acid attacks, and you have said, I'm going to continue this. And so at your university next semester, you're going to have several screenings, hopefully, of more issues, more films that address these issues. And then you've actually told me that you're very interested in writing a book about the actual incident that propelled you into human rights for women. And so you got some great things on the horizon. You're going to continue to be a voice for those voiceless women.
Yeah, exactly. But it all comes at a price. Like, I still get the threats, death threats, mutilation threats. It's scary, but it doesn't scare me enough to stop me. Like, no matter what anybody says, I'm still going to continue doing what I do. And I'm actually planning on screening Honor Diaries again next semester.
Great.
Hopefully with some guest speakers. And there's a movie about the honor killings of the sisters, Amin and Sarah Said. I want to screen that documentary too. I'll be doing a couple of presentations. And I want to write a book about my friend's brother who was actually a victim of honor killing. So a lot of things in the works. Hopefully I can complete everything.
Yes. Now, you know, one of the things you've actually said to me that your mom said, and this is important when we talk about this, she says, no one really cares about this. But you have found out in those that have come to your lectures and in the one I was at, that they really do care. They had lots of good questions for you. And there was one black sister after the lecture that said, please send me this PowerPoint. She wants to share it. So this is encouraging. You've said on an interview with me before, I want to be that ripple in the ocean and that cause and effect kind of thing with other people, that they will too take up the cause that I'm involved in.
Yeah, and after she said that, I was like, wow, it's actually happening, because all my life I've been hearing my mom say, nobody cares, why are you wasting your time? And it really got me down at times, but I don't know, it just, now I'm seeing progress. It's slow and steady, but I'm seeing progress.
What I want to ask is, this is a hard question, I'm sure, but let's get your insight onto it. Your mom says it really, no one really cares. Well, we know that's not true. But Saba, what is it we can do to make a difference? How can we be more preventative against honor killings? What would be your thoughts? Is it changing the law? Is it setting up a safe haven for those that suspect they're going to be a victim in an honor killing? What can we do positively to put an end to all of these statistics of honor killings? How can we intervene and put an end to this?
Probably changing the laws would be, and setting up a safe haven for women who do reach out, because being a Muslim woman, you're kind of, from an early age, you're kind of brainwashed to not speak up out about your troubles. If you're having problems at home, do not tell anyone. you know, if you go to anybody for help, if you go to a counselor for help, you will automatically be labeled mentally unstable. I mean, it's happened with me. I was so depressed at home because of this pendulum, this emotional rollercoaster I've been on since the beginning, that I want to do this, but I, you know, to fit in with a family and to be accepted by my family and my community, I have to conform to their standards. So it's kind of like, it's really difficult, like trying to balance the two. But at the same time, I wasn't allowed to make friends. My best friend would be my mother. So it's kind of like a sense, it's kind of like a form of control.
It is.
And I have, until now, I had no sense of independence, no sense of my own identity. Like, who am I? And just now I'm just like kind of breaking out of that shell, breaking out of that, I guess you could say shelter. But most women, most Muslim women are controlled by the fear that, you know, if I tell someone this, they're going to think I'm crazy, or I can't say this about my family, or I can't say this about my husband because my family would look bad. But there are women who need help. It's just reaching out to them or them reaching out to you. And there has to be a way for them to overcome their fear, just finding that way. And I think the only way we can do that is by educating ourselves. Like, I feel like if non-Muslims educate themselves about the religion and about the culture in the different countries, then better chance of understanding them.
Exactly. And, you know, talk to this person that might be listening today that is a little bit like you once were, afraid to break out of the mold, afraid to go against the grain. Talk to that person, that Muslim woman that could be listening and saying, I'm afraid.
I would say don't be afraid to ask for help. Seriously, like, I was afraid. And only this semester have I actually started to make friends. I found a really strong support network. I met you. You have been the greatest support I've ever had. And Zainab has been great. Thank you, Zainab. And I've met some really good friends on campus who are feminists and who actually gave me the opportunity to screen the movie Honor Diaries earlier this semester. So it's just everyone working together. I think that's all it is, just working together.
Well, it's been my pleasure to give you that support, because this issue that we're talking about today is near and dear my heart. And even though I talk a lot about Iran, I include all of the Middle East, and it needs to be talked about. It needs to be discussed. But this support that you give is very, very helpful to you. It's a circle of protection around you. And I think this is very important. What you said to someone that could be listening, do not be afraid. There is support out there. So I really appreciate, Saba, you taking the time and telling us about the issues of women's rights that are so near and dear to your heart. And just in the last minute, give us your final thoughts on all of this, your final thoughts about your future and what you're going to do.
I honestly have no idea what my future holds. All I know is I want to continue doing this. I mean, like, to please the family, I had to get a biology degree, which thankfully I'm completing this semester. But my true passion, my heart lies in women's rights. I always wanted to study law or journalism so I could actually actively help women. But I was always told, no, you cannot do that. People don't think that's a good degree. You have to go into medicine. So I was kind of like forced to do something I didn't want to do. So I told them, okay, now I've done what you wanted me to do. Now I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to continue doing what I do, and I'm going to write books. I'm going to, okay, I can't practice law, but I'm going to write, and I'm going to get the word out through my book.
This is great. I see you saying, I'm not going to be a part of this mold. I'm breaking from this mold, and you know the risk that you take. but you're saying to me, I am not going to be part of the mold. I'm not going to be like a sheep. I'm going to make a difference. And yes, it's dangerous, but you have that option. And you're saying, okay, I'm in this family situation, but I am not afraid to break the mold because the lives of women, the rights of women are more important than my own life. I hear you saying that so clearly.
Yeah, but the thing is that not everyone listens to it. Like my own mother, she's like, what can you do? You're one person. You can't change the world. I'm like, okay, I can't change the world, but I can spread the message, and yes, lots of people hear it, and together we can change the world.
I love this because you're that one person, Saba, and I want to say that one person can make a difference. And I think of Malala in Pakistan, who was shot by the Taliban, and look at the difference she has made in the rights of women in education all over the world. She's written two books. She's one person. She's got a powerful voice, and I think you got a very powerful voice, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Saba, for taking time out. I hope that you're keeping warm. This is a bitterly cold day. Thank you so much and for being here with us and educating us about the passion of your life. Thank you for being a guest today on the Cross in the Desert.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you. We'll talk to you very, very soon, okay?
Okay, take care.
Goodbye. I can't say enough good about my guest, Saba. I'm so glad we connected today. I was a little bit nervous there for a few minutes, but she was able to connect and have this most important interview today. I'm going to send it out over Twitter. I'm going to put it on my Facebook. I hope that you will spread the message and pray and give support to Saba. She is a very courageous lady, and she does it at the risk of her own life, and she is doing this because she cares, and she's passionate. So please, when I post these, please pray for this young lady. She is a beautiful person. I've met her, and I can't say enough good about her. She really means what she says. She's really courageous in all that she does. Well, right now, I want to play that song that I started to play for you earlier. It's a beautiful song about a loving God that cares for us and forgives us, even in our worst sinful moments. This is Benny Hester and When God Ran on the Cross in the Desert. I'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
You
That's Benny Hester, When God Ran, a powerful, powerful message based on the story, the parable of the prodigal son as taught so powerfully by Jesus. I'm going to talk about that again in a few minutes. I want to touch on the subject of acid attacks that we discussed on our interview today. Saba mentioned a famous person, Katie Piper, a British model who really had to dig in the trenches for hope again after this attack. I want you to hear her story right now on the cross in the desert.
Well, it was a heinous acid attack on a young London woman that left the world in horror. Take a look. At 25, Katie Piper had the world at her feet. She was a model in demand and an aspiring TV presenter. Beautiful and energetic, she certainly had her admirers. One of those was Danny. After meeting on Facebook, the two began dating, but it wasn't long before Katie began having doubts. Lynch was growing ever more controlling, becoming violent and aggressive. But it was what happened next that would change Katie's life forever.
This guy starts walking towards me, crosses the road, and he had a coffee cup. So I thought, well, this guy really wants me to give him some change. And I took my hands to get money out. And as I did and turned, he just threw everything into my face like that.
The vicious acid attack left Katie scarred, burnt, and blinded in one eye. After more than 200 procedures and an entirely new face, Katie was ready to face the world once again. It is such a remarkable story of courage and survival, and I had the pleasure of catching up with Katie late last week. Katie, thanks so much for joining us. Such an horrific attack. I think we all look at that vision and can't imagine what that was like for you. How has your recovery been in the 6 years since?
It's been a long road. It's been quite a bumpy road. There's been some incredible highs, and of course there has been some lows along the way. And I think that's the thing that any, not just any burn survivor, but anybody that's been through a trauma or a tragedy will know. It is a bit of a never-ending roller coaster.
All these years on, what do you remember of the attack?
I think now I am 6 years on. I have had lots of therapy and help with sort of moving forward. So I tend not to look back and remember like the specific event. And also in my work at the charity, I'm around so many different people that have faced adversity and overcome some incredibly difficult situations. So that kind of puts it into perspective for me, what other people go through, and helps me kind of focus on looking forward and not thinking about the past.
That is the extraordinary thing about you, because, again, looking at that vision, I think a lot of us would think that would be the end of me. I wouldn't be able to come back from it. But you have not let this defeat you. You have come out, I gather, even stronger than the woman you were before the attack. You have hit some dark points, though. Can you tell us about those and how you got through them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I finished writing the second part to my autobiography this year, and in it, it was really important for me to be honest, because obviously I've gone on to have a new relationship and just recently become a mother. So it's a very uplifting book compared to the first one, but there were really difficult times of, you know, going back into the adult world, trying to date, just trying to be a normal girl fitting in to a busy life in London. It was hard at times being rejected and trying to tell myself, actually, everyone gets rejected. And, you know, some of the guys that I went on dates with that didn't work out. And I kind of had to tell myself, maybe they haven't called me back because I'm really boring. It might not be because I'm burnt. And trying to stay strong was difficult at times. But I think it's a minefield for anybody.
And you did meet a wonderful man in James, and you now have a baby girl.
Yeah, that's right. It's my beautiful ever after with James and Belle. So, yeah, I'm really fortunate. I never take it for granted. I feel so lucky to have them both in my life.
You're an extraordinary woman, Katie Piper, and your third book, Beautiful Ever After, is out now, and it really is a must read. Lovely to chat to you.
You too. Thank you very much.
She's gorgeous.
Fabulous, and just proof that no matter what comes your way, there is a way out if you find support and help and get that positive attitude happening. It's a really good book.
Katie Piper, great stuff. Well done to you.
She's an amazing woman that has hope again. after so many surgeries. And when you watch this video, it's hard to keep back the tears at the horrific damage that was done to her face. But this is a woman of great, great courage, just like my guest, Saba, who refuses to give up, who refuses to let this destroy her life. And she is a perfect example of what hope can do in a just drastic situation. You know, I was thinking about the song Benny Hester sang for us, When God Ran, and I'm thinking about the blog I wrote about this song, The God of Irresistible Love, because when I think about the situations that Saba was describing, the hopeless situations for the families of honor attack, honor killings and acid attacks and forced marriages, the hope that we find to continue, I believe, is found in the God of the Bible, the God of great love and compassion and irresistible love. And the story that Jesus told about the prodigal son is a story that illustrates this great God of irresistible love. It's a constant theme that runs through the pages of Scripture, the theme about God's irresistible love. The Bible portrays God as a God of immeasurable love and compassion for his children, even when his children fall into idolatrous practices and chase after other gods. God pursues them with his irresistible love. Though his heart is grieved, God never stops loving his children, even when they abuse the love that he freely lavishes upon them. A perfect example of this irresistible love is found in the parable that Jesus told about the prodigal son. Jesus, as you know, was a master storyteller about the love and compassion of his heavenly Father. One day his disciples and the religious leaders gathered around him as he began to tell his most famous and favorite parable. Jesus told the story about a father who had two sons. One day his younger son demanded his share of his inheritance now. So the father divided up his wealth between the two sons. The younger son quickly departed for another country and wasted all of his inheritance on wild and promiscuous living. Desperate for money, the younger son agreed to take a job feeding pigs. There was a famine at that time in the land, and the son was so hungry that even the pig's pods looked appetizing to him. Wow. One day the son came to his senses and decided to return home. He would beg for his father's mercy and be satisfied just to become a hired servant. While he was on his way home, his father saw him afar off in the distance. At this point in the parable, Jesus emphasized how the father reacted to seeing his wayward son. Instead of being angry and bitter over what his son had done, the father was instead filled with love and compassion and ran to his son, embracing him and kissing him. The father welcomed the son in his arms of forgiveness and rejoiced that he was returning home. "We must celebrate with a feast," the father proclaimed, "for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost and now he is found." After listening to this powerful story of love and forgiveness, the religious leaders were appalled and offended. Their concept of God was one of anger and punishment, and certainly not grace and forgiveness. This parable perfectly illustrates the God that Jesus frequently spoke about. He is a heavenly Father that never stops loving his wayward and sinning children. He is a God of irresistible love that will pursue us to the end of the earth and win back our hearts and affections for him. So my question in reflecting on this parable and song by Benny Hester, what is your concept of God? What do you think about when you think about your God? Do you carry a heavy burden of guilt and shame? Jesus spoke this parable for a person just like you. Instead of being tormented by guilt, cry out to God today. And just like in the parable, he will run towards you and embrace you in his arms of mercy and compassion. And this is the God that I worship and serve. Jesus reaches out to us. He says, "Come to me, you who are weary, carry heavy burdens. Come to me, and I will give you rest." And Jesus promises this rest, this forgiveness from guilt and shame. He is the one who said, "I am the bread of life." As one of the scriptures I quoted in my book, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry again. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Anyone who is thirsty may come to me. Anyone who believes in me may come and drink. For the scriptures declare, rivers of living water will flow from his heart. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. Let anyone who hears this say, come. Let anyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who desires drink freely from the water of life. Jesus promises to quench our spiritual thirst. He offers us himself in all of his splendor, glory, love, and compassion. Our longings are satisfied by his irresistible love. When we plunge into the rivers of his love, we are healed, we are forgiven, and all of our guilt and shame is washed away forever. Truly, Jesus is the cross in the desert, a reservoir of living hope. This is in my new book, The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I want to thank my very special guest, Saba, for being on the program to talk to us about these vital issues of human rights that women need to have once again instead of honor killings, forced marriages, and acid attacks. Thank you, Saba, for your dedication, your passion, and your courage. And thank you for spending time with me today on The Cross in the Desert. I will see you very soon once again this Thursday. Have yourself a blessed week.